she took a train to the city. Her life, she would later understand, would be scarred with them. A Saturday Express. Her heart sang with desperation in her ribcage. A newspaper spun slowly on the platform in the wind. She wore the red dress her uncle had bought for her 14th birthday and the high heels that pinched savagely. She made a crown of her blonde braids. In the mirror, she'd seen no beauty in her angles and strange lashes, in her grossly fat lips, but hoped others might. She would burn later with what she didn't know. That she should have worn her bra, trimmed her pubic hair back to prepubescence, brought photographs. That such things as headshots even existed in the world. A man had watched her climb into the car from his seat in the rear. He smiled at the way she moved her body as if it were new out of the box, at the dangerous jut to her chin. After some time, he came up the corridor and sat across from her, though the car was otherwise empty. She felt him looking at her and ignored him as long as she could, and when she looked up, he was there. He laughed. He had an ugly mastiff's face, all bulging eyes and jowl. He had the eyebrows of a jokester, peaked high, giving him an air of intimate mischief, as if he were about to whisper a punchline in her ear. Despite herself, she leaned forward. This would be his effect, a pleasant mirroring, a swiftly established accord. He was the quiet hit of every party. He never said a word, but everyone believed he was simpatico. He looked at her, and she pretended to read her book, her head on fire. He leaned forward. He put his hands on her knees, the thumbs gentle on the skin of her inside thighs. He smelled delicious, like verbena and cordovan. She looked up. "I'm only 18," she said.
"All the better," he said.
She stood and went shakily to the bathroom and sat there through the pulses of the train, holding herself with her arms until the conductor said Penn Station. When she got off, she felt liberated. She was in the city, and she wanted to run and laugh. But as she walked swiftly toward what she knew was her future, she looked up into the mirrored glass by a donut store and saw the man from the train 10 feet behind her. He was unhurried. She felt the back of her heel go hot, then blister, and, on the street, a warm wash of relief when the blister burst, then the sting. She was too proud to stop. She didn't pause until she reached the building where the agency was. The guards, used to pretty, wobbly, underage girls, parted to let her in. She was inside for hours. For hours, he sat in the cafe opposite, with a hardcover book and a lemonade, waiting. When she came out, she felt deboned, her bottom lids red. Her braids had frizzed in the unseasonable heat. He followed her down the street, a plastic bag and the book in his hand, until her stride became a limp, and he stepped in front of her and offered a coffee. She'd eaten nothing since dinner the night before. She put her hands on her hips, staring, then right-faced into a sandwich shop and ordered a cappuccino and a mozzarella panini.
"Porca Madonna," he said. "Panino. It's singular."
She turned to the girl at the counter and said, "I'd like two panini, two cappuccini." He chuckled and paid. She ate the sandwiches slowly, chewing 30 times with each bite. She looked everywhere but at him. She'd never had caffeine before, and it filled her fingers with a kind of elation. She decided to drive the man off with her exigency and ordered an eclair and another cappuccino, but he paid without comment and watched her eat.
"You don't eat?" she said.
"Not much," he said. "I used to be a fat boy."
Now she could see the sad fat child in the mismatched jowls and thin shoulders, and felt something heavy in her shifting toward him.
"They said I needed to lose 10 pounds, she said.
"You're perfect," he said. "They can jump off a bridge." "They said no?"
"They said I need to lose 10 pounds and send them pictures, and they'd start me out with catalog work. Build my way up."
He considered her with a straw in the corner of his mouth.
But you were unhappy with that, because you're not a girl who starts small, he said. You are a young queen.
No, she said. She fought the emotion rising to her face and mastered it. It had begun to rain outside, hard, thick spatters on the hot pavement. A low miasma rose from the ground, and the air shifted toward coolness. She listened to the pounding of the rain as he leaned forward and took her foot in his hand and took off the shoe. He looked at the bleeding, jagged blister. He dabbed it with a paper napkin dipped in ice water and took from his plastic bag from the drugstore, which he'd visited while she was at the agency, a big box of bandages and a tube of ointment. When he was finished administering to her feet, he took out a pair of plastic shower sandals with massaging nubs.
You see, he said,
lowering her feet to the ground. She could weep for the relief.
I take care of things,
he said. He took a wet wipe from his pockets and fastidiously cleaned his hands. I see, she said.
We can be friends, you and I. I'm unmarried, he said. I'm kind to girls. I don't hurt anybody. I'll make sure you're looked after. And I'm clean.
Of course he was clean. His nails were pearly. His skin had the sheen of a soap bubble. Later, she'd hear of AIDS and understand. She closed her eyes and pulled the long-ago Mathilde, the one from the Parisian schoolyard, tighter to her body. She opened her eyes and put on her lipstick by feel. She blotted her lips on a napkin, crossed her legs, and said, "So?" He said, in a low voice,
"So, come to my apartment. I'll make you dinner. We can..."
And his eyebrows shot skyward.
"Talk."
"Not dinner, no," she said. He looked at her, calculating.
"We can make a deal, then. Negotiate. Stay the night," he said, "if you can convince your parents. Say you met a school friend in town. I can do a passable imitation of a schoolgirl's father."
"Parents aren't an obstacle," she said. "I only have an uncle. He doesn't care."
"Then what is the obstacle?" he said.
"I'm not cheap," she said.
"All right."
He leaned back. She wanted to crush the latent joke he never quite delivered, flatten it under her knuckles.
"Tell me, what is it that you most want in the world, young queen?"
She took a deep breath and pressed her knees together to stop them from shaking.
"College tuition," she said, "for all 4 years.
He put both hands flat on the table and gave a sharp laugh.
"I was thinking a handbag, but you were thinking indentured servitude," he said.
She thought, "Oh, so young, so capable of surprise." Then she thought, oh no, he had laughed at her. Her face was on fire, she felt, striding out. He was behind her at the door. He put his suit coat over her head and gestured for a cab from the awning. Maybe he was made of spun sugar, would melt in the wet. She slid in, and he stood bent in the door, but she wouldn't move over to let him in.
"We can talk about this," he said. "I'm sorry. You astonished me, that's all."
"Forget it," she said.
"How can I?" he said.
He touched her gently under the chin, and she had to fight the urge to close her eyes and rest her head in his palm.
"Call me on Wednesday," he said,
putting a card in her hand, and though she wanted to say no again, she didn't, and she didn't crumple it up. He tossed a bill over the seat to the driver and shut the door gently behind her. Later, in the window of the train, her face was pale and floating over a green spin of Pennsylvania. She was thinking so hard she noticed neither face nor landscape. She came into the city again the next Saturday. There had been a phone call. Trial gently proposed. Same red dress, heels, hair. A trial? She thought of her grandmother in Paris, her rumpled elegance, the rat-gnawed cheese on the windowsill, the blaze of her crazed dignity. Mathilde had listened from her closet and thought, "Never, never for me. I'd die first." Never's a liar. She had nothing better, and time was running out. The man was waiting outside the train station, but he didn't touch her as she sat on the leather seat of the town car. He ate a throat lozenge, and the air smelled of it. Her eyes were dry, yet the world had gone misty. A lump in her throat bigger than the neck could contain. She registered the doorman as hairy, squat, Mediterranean, though she didn't look directly at him. All inside was smooth marble.
"What's your name?"
the silvery man said in the elevator. "Mathilde," she said. "Yours?"
"Ario," he said.
She looked at herself in the reflective brass doors, a smear of red and white and gold, and said in a very low voice, "I'm a virgin." He took a handkerchief from his breast pocket and dabbed at his forehead.
"I would never have expected less of you,"
he said, and bowed elaborately as if for a joke, and held the door for her as she went in. He handed her a glass of cold, sparkling water. The apartment was enormous, or at least appeared so, walled on two sides with glass. The other walls were white, with huge paintings that registered as shimmers of color. He took off his suit jacket and hung it up and sat down and said,
"Make yourself at home."
She nodded and went to the window and looked out onto the city. After some time, he said,
"By make yourself at home, what I really meant was for you to please undress."
She turned away from him. She took off the shoes and unzipped the dress and let it pool at her feet. Her underwear was black cotton, a little girl's cut, which had made the people at the agency smile the week before. She didn't wear a bra. She didn't need one. She turned back, her arms behind her, and looked at him gravely.
"All of it,"
he said, and she slowly took off her underwear. He made her wait while he looked at her.
"Please turn around,"
he said, and she did. Outside, the buildings were obscured in the fog and dim, so that when the lights in the buildings opposite came on, they were squares floating in space. She was shuddering by the time he stood and came toward her. He touched her between the legs and smiled at the moisture he found on his fingertips. His body seemed too bony for his fleshy face and was almost hairless, save for brown coronas around his nipples and a darker arrow from navel to groin. He lay on the white couch and made her crouch above him until her thighs burned and shook. Then he seized her hips and pulled her suddenly down, smiling at the pain on her face.
"Easier to dive than wade in, my dear," he said. "Lesson one."
She didn't know what kept her from standing, dressing, escaping. The pain felt like hate. She bore the pressure by counting, staring fixedly at a golden square of window in the dark. He took her face and forced it to his.
"No," he said. "Please look at me."
She looked. There was a technological glow from the corner of the room, some digital clock, which turned the side of his head slightly green in pulses. He seemed waiting for her to flinch, but she wouldn't. She willed her features into stone, and there was a pressure that built and burst, and the relief, removal, and she stood, feeling knots in her legs and an internal burn. He cut a banana into slices and laid them on her body and slowly ate them off her, which was his dinner.
"More than that,"
he said,
"I inflate."
For her, he ordered a grilled cheese sandwich and fries from the diner across the street and watched her mouth closely as she ate every bite.
"More ketchup,"
he said.
"Lick that cheese off your finger."
In the morning, he washed her very carefully and instructed her how to trim herself, and watched from a hot bath as she put her leg on a teak chair and did so. And then he had her lie on her back in the huge white bed and point her knees upward. On the television embedded in the wall, he put on a tape with two women, red-headed and dark-haired, licking each other.
"Nobody likes what I'm about to do to you at first," he said. "You need to fantasize to make it work. Stay with it. A few times from now, you'll understand."
It was terrifying, his unlovely face there. The heat of his mouth and the scrape of the stubble. The way he watched her in her shame. It was the closest anyone had ever come to her. She'd never been kissed on the lips. She put a pillow on her face and breathed and thought of a young man without a face, just a muscular, shining body. She felt a long, slow wave building in her until it turned huge and dark and crashed down on her, and she shouted into the pillow. He pulled away from her, sudden flood of white light.
"You surprising little thing," he said, laughing.
She didn't know she hated Chinese food until he ordered it and asked her to eat it all on the rug, mushu tofu to steamed shrimp and broccoli to the last grain of rice. He had nothing. He watched.
"If you need to go home, I'll take you back to the station after you shower again."
There was a kindness in him, despite his gargoyle's face. Mathilde nodded. She'd already bathed three times in his marble shower, always after eating. She had begun to understand him.
"I just need to be back in time to go to school tomorrow," she said.
"Do you wear a uniform?"
he said.
"Yes," she said, lying.
"Oh, God,"
he groaned.
"Wear it next weekend."
She put down the chopsticks.
"You've decided."
"Depends on where you're going to college,"
she told him.
"You're smart,"
he said.
"I'm glad to hear that."
"Maybe not," she said,
motioning at the apartment around her, her own naked body with a grain of rice on her breast. She smiled, then took the smile off her face. He didn't get to know she had a sense of humor. He stood and moved to the door.
"All right. We have a deal," he said. "Come to me from Friday afternoon to Sunday evening. I'll call you my goddaughter to avoid unnecessary questions. 4 years, starting now. Intern with me at the gallery during the summers. I am eager to see how well I can teach you what you'll need to know. Do your catalog modeling if you think you need to explain your money. We'll get you on birth control. While we're together, to avoid diseases, among other horrors, please do not touch or look at another boy or girl. If I hear you even kissed someone else, our deal is off."
"I won't even think a lewd thought," she said, deliberately thinking, "black cock." "Where are you going?" she asked.
"Buying you underwear and a bra. It's disgraceful, you're going around like that underneath. You shower and take a nap, and I'll be back in a few hours."
He went toward the door, then stopped. He turned around.
"Mathilde,"
he said kindly.
"No matter what, you need to understand that this is only business. I can't have you thinking that it's more than that."
She smiled broadly for the first time.
"Business," she said. "Not a single emotion will occur. We will be as robots."
"Excellent,"
he said, and closed the door. Alone, she felt sick, dizzy. She looked at herself reflected in the window, the city slowly moving beyond. She touched her stomach, her chest, her neck. She looked at her hands and saw they were shaking. She was no more rotten than she'd been as the girl on the train, but still she turned away from the Mathilde in the glass. 2 months. High school finished, and she moved into Ariel's apartment. She had so little to take from her uncle's house. A few books, the red dress, glasses, a dog-eared photograph of herself, fat-cheeked, pretty, French, before she went bad. It all fit into her school knapsack. She left a note under the chauffeur's seat when he was using the bathroom. She couldn't see his many stomachs and chins one last time without bursting into tears. She knocked for the first time on her uncle's study door, and without waiting for him to speak, she went in. He looked up over the top of his glasses. A wedge of light from the window fell on the papers on his desk.
"Thank you for the shelter you've given me these past few years," she said.
"You're leaving?"
he said in French. He took his glasses off and sat back, looking at her.
"Where are you going?"
"A friend's," she said.
"Liar,"
he said. "Correct," she said. "I have no friends. Call him a protector."
He smiled.
"An efficacious solution to all of your problems," he said. "If, however, a more carnal one than I'd hoped. But I shouldn't be surprised. You grew up with my mother, after all."
"Goodbye," she said, and turned toward the door.
"Frankly,"
he said, and she stopped, her hand on the doorknob.
"I had thought better of you, Aurélie. I had believed you'd work for a few years, head off to Oxford or something. I had thought you would fight harder, that you were more like me. I must admit that I find myself disappointed."
She said nothing.
"Know that if you have nothing else, you can find food and a bed here, and do visit from time to time. I am curious to see how you change. I predict either something ferocious or something thoroughly bourgeois. You will be a world-eater or a mother of eight."
"I won't be a mother of eight," she said. She wouldn't visit either. There was nothing of her uncle's that she wanted. She took a last look at him, the lovely wing-like ears and round cheeks that made a liar of his face, and one side of her mouth curled up, and she bid a silent goodbye to the house as she went through, the secret masterpiece under the stairwell that she yearned to see again, and the long dark hallways with locked doors and the huge oak front door. Then she was in the air. She began to run down the packed dirt lane in its blaze of white sun, her legs swinging goodbye, goodbye to the ruminants in the Mennonite fields, the June breeze, the wild blue flocks on the bank. This sweat she worked up was a glorious one. The long summer of her 19th year. The things one can do with a tongue, a breath, the taste of latex, smell of oiled leather. Box seats at Tanglewood. Her blood thrilled, his voice warm in her ear before a Jackson Pollock spatter, and suddenly she saw the brilliance. Sultry heat, pisco sours on the terrace, and ice cubes painful slow melt on her nipples as he watched from the door. He taught her. This is how you cut your food, order your wine. This is how you make people believe you agree with their opinions without saying anything at all. Something softened around his eyes, but she pretended not to see it. Business, she said to herself, her knees burning on the tile in the shower. He put his hands in her hair. He brought her presents, bracelets, videos that made her face hot, underwear no more than 3 strings and a patch of lace. And then college. It went far faster than she thought it would. Classes like flashes of light, blips of dark weekends, light again. She drank her classes in. She did not make friends. Ariel took up so much time, and the rest was taken by studying, and she knew that if she made one friend, she'd be too hungry to stop. On soft spring days, forsythia sunbursts in the corners of her eyes, her heart was rebellious. She would easily have fucked the first boy who walked by, but she had so much more to lose than the thrill she'd gain. She watched longingly, chewing her fingernails to blood as the others hugged, laughed, passed inside jokes. On Friday afternoons, on the trains down the dusk-sparked Hudson, she hollowed herself out.
When she modeled, she pretended to be the kind of girl who felt insouciant in bikinis, who was glad to show her new lace brassiere to the gaping world. Her best shots were those where she thought of doing physical violence to the photographers. In the apartment, rug burn, lips bitten. He ran a hand down her back, cleaved her buttocks. Business, she thought. The train back to college, each mile an expansion. 1 year, two. Summers in the apartment and the gallery, like a fish in an aquarium. She learned. 3 years, four. Senior spring, her whole life ahead of her, almost too much brightness to look at directly. Something in Ariel had grown frantic. He took her to four-hour dinners, told her to meet him in the bathroom. She woke Sunday mornings to find him watching her.
"Come work for me," he said thickly, once when she, on his cocaine, unspooled a full essay out of her brain about the genius of Rothko. "Work for me at the gallery, and I'll train you, and we can take over New York."
"Maybe," she said agreeably, thinking,
"Never."
Thinking,
"Business."
Soon, she promised herself. Soon, she would be free at last. 11. She was alone for an afternoon. She came downstairs to find that God had chewed the kitchen rug, had left a mess of urine on the floor, was looking at her with a bellicose light in her eye. Mathilde showered, put on a white dress, let her hair drip the fabric wet. She put the dog into her crate, her toys and food in a plastic bag, put it all in the car. The dog screamed in the back, then settled. She stood outside the general store in town until she saw a family she vaguely knew. The father was the man they'd hired to plow their driveway in winter, with a steer rustler's face, maybe a little slow. The mother was the dental receptionist, a big woman with small ivory teeth. The children had gorgeous fawn eyes. Mathilde knelt to their level and said, "I want to give you my dog." The boy sucked three fingers, looked at God, nodded. The girl whispered,
"I can see your boobies."
"Mrs. Satterwhite," the mother said. Her eyes flicked over Mathilde, and by this, Mathilde knew she was dressed inappropriately. Ivory dress, designer. She hadn't been thinking. Mathilde put the dog in the husband's arms. "Her name is God," she said. The woman gasped, then said, "Mrs. Satterwhite?" But Mathilde was walking to her car.
"Hush, Donna," she heard the man say. "Let the poor lady be."
She drove home. The house echoed, empty. Mathilde had been liberated. She had nothing to worry about now. So long ago it was. That day the light had fallen from the sky as if through green blown glass. Her hair had been long then, sun shot blonde. Skinny legs crossed, reading the moonstone. She bit her cuticle to blood and thought of her boyfriend, a love 1 week tender, and the world was made bright with him. "Lotto," said the train as it came. "Lotto, lotto, lotto." The short, greasy boy watching her from the bench was invisible to her, because she had her book. She had her joy. To be fair, she hadn't met Charlie yet. Since Mathilde and Lotto had found each other, Lotto had spent every spare moment with her, had ceded his dorm room to his childhood friend, who was illegally auditing classes, not an actual student at the school. Lotto had time for nothing but Mathilde, rowing, and classes. But Charlie knew of her. He was there at the party when Lotto looked up and saw Mathilde and she saw him, when Lotto crushed a crowd of people to get to her. It had been only a week. It couldn't be serious yet, Charlie had believed. She was pretty, if you were into stick figures, but he figured Lotto would never tie himself to one pussy at 22, with his whole life of glorious fuckery ahead of him. Charlie was sure that if Lotto had been perfectly handsome, he would never have the success he did. His bad skin, his big forehead, the slightly bulbous nose moderated what was an almost girlishly pretty face into something sexy. And then, just the day before, he'd caught sight of Lotto and Mathilde together under the confetti of an overblown cherry tree, and he felt the air knocked out of his chest. Look at them together. The height of them. The shine on them. Her pale and wounded face, a face that had watched and never smiled, now never stopped smiling. It was as if she'd lived all her life in the chilly shadows and someone had led her out into the sun. And look at him, all his restless energy focused tightly on her. She sharpened something that threatened to go diffuse in him. He watched her lips as she spoke and took her chin gently between his fingers and kissed her with his long lashes closed, even while she was speaking, so that her mouth moved and she laughed into his kiss. Charlie knew immediately that it was correct, that they were in very deep. Whatever was between them was explosive, made even the professors gape as they passed by. The threat of Mathilde, Charlie had understood then, was real. He, Stryver, knew another Stryver when he saw one. He who'd had no home had found a home in Lotto, and she had usurped even this. The Saturday after this one in the train station, Charlie would be napping in Lotto's bed, hidden under a heap of clothes, and Lotto would come in, smiling so broadly that Charlie would stay silent when he could have spoken and made his presence known. Lotto, ecstatic, would pick up the phone and call his fat hog of a mother in Florida, who had once threatened to castrate Charlie years ago. There would be banter. Weird relationship, that one. And then Lotto would tell his mother he was married. Married? But they were babies. Charlie was shocked cold, missing much of the conversation, until Lotto left again. It couldn't be true. He knew it was true. After some time had passed, he had wept bitterly, poor Charlie, under his heap of clothes. But on this day, before they were married, there was still time to save his Lotto from this girl. So here he was. He climbed onto the train behind Mathilde, sat behind her. A lock of her hair escaped the crevasse between seat backs, and he sniffed it. Rosemary. She got off at Penn Station, and he followed, up from the underground stink to heat and light. She went toward a black town car, and the chauffeur opened the door, and she was swallowed up. Midday in crowded Midtown, Charlie kept up on foot, though he was quickly sweating, and his breastlets were heaving with effort. When the car paused before an Art Deco building, she got out and went in. The doorman was a silverback gorilla in a costume, some kind of Staten Island accent. Bluntness would be key. Charlie said, "Who's that blonde?" The doorman shrugged. Charlie took out a 10 and gave it to him. The doorman said, "Girlfriend of 4B. Charlie looked at him, but the doorman put out his hand, and Charlie gave him all he had, which was a joint. The man grinned and said, "She been coming for too many years for a girl so young, you dig me? He's some kind of art dealer. Name's Ariel English." Charlie waited, but the man said mildly, "That's all you get for a little bud, little bud." Later, Charlie sat waiting in the window of the diner across the street. He watched. His sweaty shirt dried, and the waitress grew tired of asking if he wanted to order and just slopped coffee into his mug and went away. When the shadows engulfed the building across the street, he almost gave up, headed back to his squat in academia. There were options. He'd look in the phone book for galleries. He'd research. But then the doorman straightened and opened the door crisply, and out came a chimera, a man with a jowly face and a body like a wisp of smoke poured into a suit. Wealth in the way he moved, his sleek grooming. Behind him, there was an animated mannequin. It took Charlie a moment to recognize Mathilde. Her heels were tall, her schoolgirl's skirt cut nearly to the crotch, her hair swept high, far too much makeup. She had refused to extend the terms of the arrangement beyond 4 years. In pique, Ariel had dressed her, knowing how to cut. Her face was bare of that constant low-level smile that she wore, both shield and magnet. Blank, it was something like an abandoned building. She walked as if unaware of the world around her, that her nipples were visible under her gauzy shirt. They crossed the street, and there was dread in Charlie when he saw that they were coming into the diner toward him. They sat in a corner booth. The man ordered for both, egg white Greek omelet him, chocolate milkshake her. He watched their upside-down bodies in the chrome napkin dispenser. She ate nothing, gazed at air. Charlie saw the man whispering in her ear, saw his hand disappear in the darkness between her legs. She let it, passive. On the surface, beneath, the controlled burn. Charlie was overwhelmed. He felt a swift spinning in him. Fury for Lotto, fear of losing what he, Charlie, had worked so hard to keep. He stood in agitation and went back on the train, drawn through the dusk, and pressed his burning face against the cool glass and, at last home at Vassar, collapsed for a brief nap into Lotto's bed to plan how to tell him about his new girl, who she secretly was, a whore. But he fell asleep. He woke to laughter in the common room, the sound of a television, past midnight on the flashing clock. He came out and almost fell down with astonishment. The only explanation? Mathilde must have a twin. He'd followed the wrong girl to the city. There was a girl in Lotto's lap in sweatpants and a messy ponytail, laughing at something he was whispering in her ear. She was so different from what he'd seen that he knew he was wrong in having seen it. A dream? A half-eaten popover with apple butter was on the table, and Charlie almost lurched for it, he was so hungry.
"Hey!" Lotto bellowed. "Charlie, you haven't met my..."
He laughed.
"My Mathilde. My girl I'm madly in love with. Mathilde, this is Charlie, my oldest friend."
"Oh," she said, and leapt up and moved toward Charlie, towering over him. "I'm so happy to meet you," she said. "I've heard all the stories." She paused, then hugged him, and she smelled of plain ivory soap and, aha, rosemary shampoo. Many years later, when the gardener would try to grow rosemary on the patio of the penthouse, Charlie would toss the plants 30 stories to the sidewalk below and watch them explode in mushroom clouds of dirt.
"You," he said. "I've seen you before." "Hard to miss. 6 feet of perfect. Legs to the moon," Lotto said. "No," Charlie said. "Today, on a train to the city. I'm sure it was you."
The slightest of hesitations, then Lotto said,
"Must have been some other stunner. She was writing her French final in the computer room all day. Right, Em?"
How narrow Mathilde's eyes had gone when she laughed. Charlie felt their coldness on him.
"All morning, yeah," she said. "But I was done fast. It was only a 10-pager. When you were at your rowing lunch, I went off to the city, to the Met. We have to do an ekphrastic poem for my writing class, and I didn't want to do the same dumb Monet water lily from the campus museum that everyone else is doing. I just got back, actually. Thank you for reminding me," she said to Charlie. "I bought Lotto something at the gift shop."
She went to her overlarge purse and pulled out a book. It had a Chagall painting on the cover, Charlie would see later when he stole it. Mathilde had also stolen it, just as she left Ariel's apartment for the very last time. She'd gotten her last check. Now she was free to sleep with Lotto.
"Winged Cupid painted blind," Lotto read. "Art inspired by Shakespeare, aw," he said, kissing her chin. "It's perfect."
She looked at Charlie, another glimmer through the dark. This time, perhaps not so benign. "Fine," Charlie thought. "You'll see how well I can wait. When you're least expecting it, I will explode your life. Only fair. She had exploded his. A plan began to itch at the back of his brain. He smiled at her and saw himself reflected in the darkened window. He liked how he looked so different in reflection, so much thinner, paler, so much more blurred than he was in life. 12. Her husband hadn't woken her with a mug of coffee. Every day they had lived under the same roof, he had woken her with a cup of milky coffee. Something was wrong. She opened her eyes to full morning. Inside her, an abyss. She couldn't see all the way to its black bottom. She dawdled, washed her face, talked to the dog who ran from Mathilde to the door frantically, opened the curtains to find the world deep in midwinter gloom, stared down the stairwell for a long time. Barrel of a gun, she thought. He's left me, she thought. I knew from the moment I saw him that this day would come. She came down the dim steps, and he wasn't in the kitchen. She whispered to calm herself as she climbed up to his study in the attic. A crumble of relief when she came in the door and saw him sitting at his desk. His head was down. He must have worked all night and fallen asleep. She looked at him, the leonine hair with the gray temples, the magnificent forehead, the soft, full lips. But when she touched him, his skin was lukewarm. His eyes were open, empty as mirrors. He was not resting there. Not at all. She slid behind him in the chair and pressed herself to him, tailbone to nape. She put her hands up his shirt, feeling the thin rubber of his belly flap. Her finger went into his navel to the second knuckle. She put her hands down his pajama pants and his boxer briefs, where it was still warm. The wool of pubic hair, the satin head of him humble in her palm. For a long time she held him. She felt the heat of him leave. She stood only when she could no longer recognize his body, like a word repeated until it has lost all meaning. 13. Mathilde was ambushed in the pool by Charlie. She had been 6 months and 1 week without her husband. Charlie left his car a mile up the road and hoofed it so she couldn't hear him and flee to the pool house and hide. She had eschewed a bikini that morning for a full-body browning. Who was she going to scandalize? The crows? Her sear, unloved body of a widow. But here Charlie was at the edge of the pool, groaning. She peered at him through her sunglasses and wiped her cheeks with her palms. Little goblin man. Once he'd tried to push her into a bathroom at a party, and she'd had to knee him in the nads to get him away from her. "Fuck, Charlie," she said. She paddled to the side of the pool and climbed out. "I can't have a little solitude. Hand me that towel," she said. He did, if with excruciating slowness.
"There's solitude, and then there's suicide," he said. "You look like a chemo patient with that hair, or lack thereof."
"Why are you here?" she said.
"Everyone's worried. I've gotten 10 calls in the past week alone. Danica thinks you're going to do yourself in."
"Well, now you can go home and report that I'm alive," she said.
"So I see,"
he said, grinning.
"Vividly. In the flesh. I'm too hungry to drive. Feed me."
She sighed. "The only thing I have is ice cream," she said, "and it's pistachio." He followed her into the kitchen, and while she scooped the ice cream for him, he reached for the letter perched in its blue bowl of tomatoes. He was always grabby, looking at things that didn't concern him. She once found him in her office, reading the strange, spiky pieces of fiction she wrote on scraps. "Hands off," she said now. "Not for you." They went out to sit on the warm stones of the veranda while Charlie ate.
"It appears that I have a long history of sneaking up on you," Charlie said.
He belched and drove the spoon into the ground. She thought of his hands on her forearms at some long-ago party, the need in his face, the tongue he'd once shoved into her ear. "Yes, we all know you're a pervert," she said.
"No. I mean, yes, but no. I'm thinking of something else. Did you know? I followed you once. Back at Vassar. I hadn't met you yet. You and Lotto had just gotten together, and I knew there was something sketchy about you. So I followed you to the city."
Mathilde went still.
"Strange to see the new girlfriend of my best friend getting into some limo. Don't know if you remember, but I was fit back then, and I kept up. You got out and went into an apartment. So I sat in a diner across the way. You remember that diner?"
"Couldn't forget," she said. "And you were fat back then. You've never been fit, Chal."
"Ha! Anyway, you came out in this awful outfit. See-through shirt, miniskirt like a band-aid. And you're with this weird, flabby-faced man who put his hands up your skirt. And I think, huh, my buddy Lotto is the best person on the planet. Loyal as shit and kind, and lets me crash with him, and is more my family than my family. Just brilliant, this real fucking genius, though I don't really think anybody knew that back then, but there was something in him. Charisma. Gentleness. A kind of acceptance of people for who they are. That's rare, you know? Someone who never, never judges. Most people have a nasty interior monologue going on at all times, not Lotto. He'd rather think kindly of you. Easier that way. And he was so good to me. My family was a bunch of sadistic assholes, and I quit high school halfway through senior year so I could get away. And the only person on the planet who showed me consistent kindness was Lotto. From the time I was 17, Lotto was my home. So, anyway, here's this astounding person, best person I ever knew, and his girlfriend is sneaking off to New York to fuck some old dude? So I go home, all ready to tell my best friend his girl is sleeping around, because what kind of person would lead Lotto on like that? I mean, the kind of person who'd hang a puppy for fun. The kind of girl who'd marry him for the money. But somehow, you beat me back to the dorm. Or I fell asleep. I don't remember. But I came out, and then I saw the way you and he were together, and I knew I couldn't tell him. Not yet. Because I saw then that he was cooked. He was so deep into you that if I said anything, it'd be me to get the boot. Not you."
She was squinting at a troop of ants on the hot gray stone. He waited, but she wouldn't say anything, so he said,
"So I thought I'd sit back and wait my time, and then drive the knife in when nobody was expecting it."
24 years, and he died before you could," she said softly. "Too bad. Tragedy."
"Wrong," he said.
She looked at him, sweating, pink. The last month before Lotto died returned to her. His sullenness, his monosyllables, the way he looked flinchingly in her direction. She searched for the last time they had seen Charlie together before Lotto died, and suddenly she saw the night in Ariel's gallery, where he'd dragged her for Natalie's posthumous opening. Huge metallic sculptures with screaming faces in them, the place turned into a fairy tale forest, all shadowy and dark. Perhaps, she had told herself, it had been so long, perhaps there was no more danger in Ariel. But some pretty little waiter boy spilled red wine all over her silk dress, and she hurried off to blot it away. And when she came back, her husband had been replaced by a robot that looked like him, a man who didn't smile when he looked at her, who spoke to her glancingly, who, later, seethed. Somewhere between the moment he kissed her gently on the forehead before the wine glass tipped off the tray and, with terrible slowness, spilled on her skirt, and the moment she returned, Charlie had told him about her arrangement with Ariel. The world flickered before her. He saw the understanding and laughed and said,
"My dick's on the table, baby. I play a long game."
"Why?" she said.
"You took him,"
he said, and his voice came out too raspy, too quick. He shuffled his glasses on his nose, folded his hands.
"He was the only person I had, and you took him. But also, you're a bad person who never deserved him."
"I meant," she said, "why now? Why not 10 years ago? Why not 20 years from now?"
"We both know how much our old friend loved vagina, any and all. And frankly, dear, I always knew that someday yours would be getting pretty old, all flabby and loose, menopause setting in soon. And poor Lotto had always longed for a kid of his own. With you out of the way, he could have had the kid he wanted. And we all wanted to give him what he wanted, didn't we?"
She did not trust herself not to kill him with the spoon. She stood and came inside and locked the door behind her. For hours after she'd watched Charlie walk down the gravel drive, Mathilde sat in the kitchen. Night fell, and she didn't turn on the lights. For dinner, she opened a bottle of gift wine from some producer of Lotto's play years ago, wildly expensive and smoky and lingering on her tongue. When the bottle was finished, she stood and went all the way up to her husband's studio at the top of the house. His jade plant, so long neglected, had blackened. His books were splayed, wide-winged around the room. His papers were still spread on the desk. She sat on the leather chair and sank into the divot made by long years under her husband's weight. She rested her head on the wall behind her, where it was shiny from his head. She looked at the window where he'd dreamt for so many hours, lost in his imaginings, and was filled with a kind of dark tingle. She felt enormous, the size of the house, crowned with the moon, wind in her ears. Grief is pain internalized, abscess of the soul. Anger is pain as energy, sudden explosion. This one would be for Lotto. "This will be fun," she said aloud to the empty house. 14. Graduation day. Hills purple, sun astringent. The processional went too fast, so everyone was out of breath and laughing. Swift glimpse of Charlie's fat face squeezed among the bystanders, unsmiling. Mathilde hadn't bothered to tell her uncle she was graduating. She would have liked to see the driver, but she didn't know his real name. She hadn't spoken to Ariel since the last trip to the city, just after her final rent check went through, the contract fulfilled. Nobody was here to see her. Well, she hadn't expected anyone. They poured into the quad and endured the long speeches and some comedian she couldn't listen to because Lotto was in the row ahead of her, and she stared at the pink curl of his ear, wanting to put it in her mouth and suck. She walked across the stage to polite applause. He walked across the stage to a roar. "Terrible to be so popular," she said later, after the confetti of caps, and they found each other, kissed. The quickie in his dorm room before he packed up, her tailbone on the hard oak desk, the shushing laughter when there was a knock on the door.
"Just about to take a shower," he called out. "Be out in a sec."
"What?"
It was his baby sister, Rachel, her voice at knob level in the hall.
"Oh, shoot,"
he whispered.
"Just a second,"
he shouted, blushing, and Mathilde bit his shoulder to keep from laughing. When Rachel came in, Lotto was whooping at the cold water in the shower, and Mathilde was on her knees, packing his shoes into a cardboard box.
"Hello," she said to the little girl,
who was, poor thing, nothing close to as stunning as her brother. Long, skinny nose, tiny jaw, close eyes, dun-colored hair, taut as a guitar string. How old? 9 or so. She stood in her pretty, frilly dress, goggling, and said with a gasp,
"Oh, you're so pretty."
"I like you already," Mathilde said, and she stood and walked over and bent and gave the girl a kiss on the cheek. And then Rachel saw her brother coming out of the bathroom, steam rolling off his shoulders in a towel, and ran over to hug him around the waist, and he hooted and said,
"Rachel! Rachy Ray!"
Behind Rachel came Aunt Sally, ferret-faced, of the same gene pool as the little girl.
"Oh, my,"
Sally said, stopping short on beholding Mathilde. A blush rose out of her high lace neckline.
"You must be my nephew's girl. We were wondering who'd be special enough to pin him down, and now I see. Nice to meet you. You can call me Sally."
Lotto was looking at the door, his face darkening.
"Is Mother in the restroom?"
he said.
"She's still making her way up the steps?"
Clear as a window pane. Get his mother and wife in the same room, and they'd fall in love, he was thinking. Oh, sweet boy. Mathilde shored her shoulders, jutted her chin, waiting for Antoinette to enter. The glance exchanged, the situating. She had gotten a note that morning in her campus mailbox. "Don't think," it said, "that I don't see you." Unsigned, but smelling of Antoinette's roses. Mathilde had saved it in a shoebox that one day would be full of such notes. But Sally said,
"Nope. Sorry, baby boy. She sent her regards. She gave me this to give you."
And she handed over an envelope, the check in it visible against the light of the window, the handwriting Sally's, not his mother's.
"Oh,"
Lotto said.
"She loves you," Sally said.
"Sure,"
Lotto said, and turned away. What Lotto couldn't pack into his station wagon, he put out for the scavengers to pluck. He owned so little, Mathilde would always love his indifference to things. After he'd carried everything up to her apartment to keep there the last week of her lease, they went off to an early dinner with Sally and Rachel. Mathilde sipped her wine to hide her emotion. She couldn't remember the last time she had sat as a part of a family, let alone in such a peaceful and decorous place as this quiet, fern-lined room with its white cloths and brass chandeliers, the happy graduates and their boozing parents. On their side of the table, Lotto and Sally were out storytelling each other, cackling.
"You thought I didn't know what you were up to with that caretaker's whelp in the old hen house when you were little?"
she was saying, and his face was pink and shining with pleasure.
"All that poking and prodding and guilty, sweaty pumpkin heads when you came out? Oh, sweet meat, you forget I can see clear through walls."
Then she made a face, as if remembering Rachel, but Rachel was paying her no mind. She was staring at Mathilde, blinking so rapidly Mathilde worried for her eyelids.
"I like your necklace,"
the girl whispered. Mathilde put her hand up to her neck, touched it. It was gold, with a large emerald, which Ariel had given her last Christmas. The green was meant to go with her eyes, but her eyes were changeable. She took it off her neck and put it on Rachel's. "It's yours," she said. Later, she would think of this gift, so impulsive, the $10,000 necklace to a little girl, and feel warmed by it, even during their decade in the underground apartment in Greenwich Village, even when Mathilde didn't eat lunch so they could pay for phone service. It was cheap to buy a lifetime of friendship. The little girl's eyes went wide, and she took the emerald in her fist and nestled her head into Mathilde's side. When Mathilde looked up, she went still. At the next table sat Ariel. He was looking at her over his untouched salad, his mouth smiling, but his eyes as cold as scales. She wouldn't look away. She let her face go slack and stared back until Ariel motioned to the waiter. He murmured something, and the waiter hurried off.
You've got goosebumps,
Rachel said, touching Mathilde's arm. And then the waiter was standing too close to Mathilde and opening up a bottle of extremely nice champagne, to which Sally snapped, I didn't order.